It's Wednesday, and that means it's time for a weekly discussion of the latest in state politics with the Dakota Political Junkies. Joining us today is Jonathan Ellis, reporter and columnist with the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. And Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks, Carl.
Also with us on the line is Rapid City Journal Enterprise reporter Seth Tupper. And Seth, thanks for joining us as well.
You're welcome.
Well, yesterday, Sioux Falls restaurant owner Steve Hildebrand accused an executive of a title loan company of sabotaging his coffee house by rounding up homeless people and using them to drive away his regular customers. Hildebrand is one of the leaders of a ballot initiative that would cap payday loan interest rates at 36%. Jonathan, you've been reporting on this. What's happening at Hildebrand's coffee house?
Well, you thought the abortion battles were tough, right? How about payday lending? It's interesting. I was there yesterday, and we have another reporter there today. Via social media, I mean, people are rallying around Steve Hildebrand. And Josiah's has really become, it's quite a nice restaurant in downtown Sioux Falls. But what has started to happen over the last couple of days is two or three weeks, is you've had large groups of homeless people sort of showing up and overwhelming, the restaurant and taking up seats and that kind of thing. And potentially, I mean, the fear would be, if you're Steve, is sort of driving away the regular customers who can't, even get in to get an order in. This follows a meeting that Steve had with a title loan executive that occurred last month, a guy who just sort of showed up out of nowhere. He's from Atlanta, showed up on his private jet, according to Steve, and, some thinly veiled threats about how nice his restaurant is and how come you're trying to destroy my livelihood. So it's gotten to be, if accurate, and I think Steve presented some evidence at a press conference that one of the so-called missionaries who are here in town feeding homeless people is actually somebody tied to the industry. If accurate, I mean, this would certainly represent a very unique and certainly hardball form of politics.
Now, Hildebrand is also accusing the payday industry of starting a competing petition, drive the cap's interest rates at 18%, but lenders could charge more if borrowers sign a contract agreeing to higher terms. Looking at this, Jonathan, is this an attempt to keep the whole payday loan initiative off the ballot?
Most definitely it is. And this is exactly what happened in Missouri. And I think that the industry has learned, and I'm not trying to judge one way or another on this. The industry has learned, though, that if this gets on the ballot, and it's gotten on the ballot in a few states, Montana being next door to one of us, Ohio and Arizona, if this actually gets on the ballot, the payday, the industry has lost each time it's gone to the voters in terms of whether or not to keep, lower the interest rates or cap the interest rates or in a couple other cases, the legislature has, or the voters have affirmed what the legislature has done. So the industry has learned that once this thing gets on the ballot, they lose. And what they did learn through Missouri was they did set up some competing ballot initiatives, much like this one that you described here, Carl, with the 18%, except if you sign away a contract, then you can, any interest rate, which basically does away with, any kind of cap. But the industry has learned, they did this in Missouri, that if they can keep something off the ballot, then they have a chance of winning.
Well, Seth Tupper, looking at the way this issue is starting to play out, what do you think these hardball tactics could backfire here?
Well, they certainly could, and of course, there's a lot of time before the election, and you always have to keep that. By election time, something like this could be forgotten. If it continues, obviously, it could backfire against the industry. Steve Hildebrand has a chance to play the victim here. He may actually be a victim. I don't know. I've just been watching the reporting from Sioux Falls, but he's certainly, reaching out to the media and playing up that aspect of the story, and that could play to his advantage both, in protecting his business, but also could play to his advantage in this ballot issue if it goes to an election, to make it look like, the big bad wolf is not only out to get, people who use these payday loan places, but also is out to, vindictively punish anybody who tries to challenge them. So you know, it's if you know if they're going to play this kind of hardball, then yeah, I mean, it definitely has a potential to backfire.
And Seth, are you seeing much happening with this issue in Rapid City yet?
No, not really. You know, with the people that really, you know, with Steve Hickey and Steve Hildebrand being the people sort of behind it, and both of them being in Sioux Falls, really the activity seems to be centered there, and I haven't seen a whole lot of activity around it here out west yet.
Well, in also looking ahead to the election of 2016, away from the ballot issues, Democratic State Representative Paula Hawk said in May that she would make a decision before July about challenging Republican U.S. Representative Kristi Noem in the next election in 2016, and she appears to have a website saying she's running for the House, at least at the very least it's a test website. Jonathan, has there been any official word about her candidacy?
Nothing official that I'm aware of. I actually tried to call her about 10-15 minutes ago. Just I called her back in April when allegedly she was going to make an announcement, I think at the McGovern Day dinner. That didn't happen. But there's just been this sort of on again, off again talk about whether she's going to be a candidate. That website is certainly would indicate that, yeah, she's, you know, this test website, that she's going to be a candidate. But again, you know, nothing official, no big, you know, and when you'd announce something like this, you'd probably do a big statewide deal where you go from Sioux Falls to Mitchell to, you know, Rapid City. You'd try to do that all in one day and make a big splash. That has not happened yet.
Well, Seth Tupper, if Paula Hawks is a candidate, will she need to make that announcement pretty soon?
Oh, not necessarily. I think she's taking this straight out of the modern political playbook, which is you drag this out as long as you can to get all the free publicity that you possibly can. I mean, first you put out word that you're considering something, and then you put out word that you're going to make some kind of an announcement, but you don't say what the announcement is, and then you make the announcement, and you get news coverage, and you get people like us talking about it all along the way, and it's in a way it's kind of a free form of advertising that you just kind of milk as long as you can, I guess. Until you make the announcement, and by then, of course, everybody realizes that she's running, but you still get the coverage anyway. So I don't know that there's any hurry, and it seems like she's following that tried and true path of just milking the coverage for as long as she can, and the will she or won't she, you know, debate.
People, the general public, other than people like us, political reporters, Seth, pay much attention to the way these campaigns seem to be rolling out these days?
I don't think so, but, you know, it does, the way that's done, I mean, it does help with name recognition. Obviously, Paula Hawks doesn't have a lot of statewide name recognition, so just the more times that she can get her name appearing in newspapers, mentioned on TV and radio, you know, and the more times she can do that for free through news coverage, the more it benefits her. And I think that's what she needs. And so the more speculation she can fuel, the better it is for her.
I know there are differing opinions about when candidates should announce that they're running for office. Jonathan Ellis, I'm wondering if from your perspective, the state fair is coming up. Is that any sort of deadline for candidates?
Well, the state fair, you know, yeah, I mean, it would be nice, especially if you could entice. I mean, and this, it would probably be too early, but if you were running a competitive campaign already as a challenger and you could entice somebody to some debates, I mean, that would be nice. I mean, certainly there would be debates next year at that state fair, but, you know, I think, you know, one of the advantages to announcing now is that you can start raising money. But, you know, I think Seth points out, I mean, a lot of people aren't really tuned in and, you know, aren't going to take notice of this stuff until, you know, 6 weeks before the election anyway. So the big advantage is you can start to get your name out and get some name recognition, but the big advantage to announcing earlier is simply by raising money.
What would it take, Seth, do you think, for Paula Hawks to run a competitive campaign against Republican Kristi Noem?
Well, as I've said before, unfortunately, it'll take money. You have to get your message out, and as we saw with Corinna Robinson last time, she just never was able to, establish a real significant fundraising effort, and she didn't really get her message out, and she just never really presented a serious challenge. So, you know, I think that's number one, that's what it'll take. And obviously you got to put in the work and go around the state and meet people. But, you know, the way you get your message out to a mass audience is on in newspapers, on TV and radio, and that takes money, and she'll need to do that.
Now, Senator John Thune is up for re-election in 2016. Last time he ran for office, the Democrats didn't have a candidate. What happens, Jonathan, if Democrats fail to have anyone to run against Thune? And that's assuming that they don't. I guess the whole speculation is still out there. Who would the Democrat be?
Well, maybe the reason Paula Hawks hasn't announced yet is because they're going to change the website from Hawks to U.S. Senate. I don't know, but it was a disaster that they didn't run somebody in 2010, and you look at why, you know, the fact that they didn't is why John Thune has about $11 million sitting in the bank right now, because he didn't have to run a re-election campaign. Now it's almost insurmountable in terms of money that they would have to raise to even come close to that. So, I mean, it was a disaster in 2010. I mean, you know, the political environment is for Democrats here in South Dakota is probably even more toxic now, again nationally, than it probably even was then. And so, it's a big challenge for them. But they do need to find somebody. I mean, they need to find somebody that can at least mount a sort of reputable challenge just for the sake of the party. They need to find somebody.
Seth Tupper, how damaging would it be for Democrats if they didn't have a candidate to run against Senator Thune?
Well, I think it'd be incredibly damaging. You know, one of the big reasons he has so much money now is because he didn't have to spend any of it, you know, the last time he was up for election, and he just kept, you know, banking more and more of it. And so, I mean, even if you're not terribly competitive, at least you cause him to spend some of that money that he's built up over the years on campaign advertising, et cetera. So it just puts you back that much more and makes the mountain to climb the next time he runs even that much higher to try to beat him. And it is kind of funny that this is the guy who had the guts to challenge Tim Johnson and the guts to challenge Tom Daschle. It's kind of funny that now he's the guy that everybody's afraid to challenge. I mean, he kind of showed nothing's a sure thing in politics by upsetting Tom Daschle, and yet people are afraid to run against him. So, I mean, yeah, it's I think it's crucial that they find somebody to run, that they cause him to at least spend some of the money that he's built up, and if they don't, then they're just again that much further behind.
Well, moving from the current South Dakota senator, we'll talk about our past senator, George McGovern. On Sunday, Sioux Falls Argus Leader published Jonathan's story about just-released files about McGovern, who was also the 1972 Democratic presidential candidate. They revealed that McGovern fathered a child in the early 40s before he was married. Jonathan, how did the Argus Leader get the files to begin with?
You know, we'd requested those files, I believe, probably that actually the day he died. I mean, it was well publicized. He'd been in hospice for a brief period before he died, and routinely that's something we do with public officials. We did that with Bill Janklow as well. It took two and a half years to get the records, and so we received them, and I very quickly, assuming that other probably media outlets had also requested them, went through them as quickly as I could. I mean, there's a large volume of material to go through, and then we picked out what we thought was the most interesting thing. And obviously, you talk about the what they quote illegitimate child. That was obviously something that stood out in the files. But I hoped that my story wasn't going to be overly salacious in that matter. I mean, what I was, from a historian, from a historical point of view, really this feud between McGovern and J. Edgar Hoover was fascinating. And the fact that, the FBI would mine this kind of, try to find dirt on anybody, try to find all the skeletons in the closet, and then use it as leverage against people. And that was really the gist of the story.
Seth Tupper, what are your thoughts on the these FBI files, assuming that you read them and saw Jonathan's story?
Oh yeah, I was very interested in Jonathan's story. I've spent quite a few years in Mitchell and interviewed Senator McGovern on a number of occasions. And one of my interests in the story is on another level, which is as a journalist. how do things become stories or not become stories, get noticed, not get noticed, in communicating with Jonathan and doing my own web searching after the fact, because I was curious, you know, how did this never come out that he apparently fathered a child, you know, all these years ago. And as Jonathan mentioned to me, and as you can find now if you go out and Google it, there was some reporting on this nationally in the 70s. There was mention in a couple of books in 09 and 12. But yet it never, I never knew anybody in South Dakota who knew this, and it certainly never came up, you know, in the years leading up to McGovern's death, and was never reported. And so it's just kind of a strange deal, a secret that was hidden, but yet was kind of hiding in plain sight. And so, yeah, I mean, those are my thoughts on it, is it's kind of a study case for journalists, and, you know, where does information come from, and how does a secret stay hidden, and why doesn't it come out, or why does it? And it's just a fascinating thing that has sort of lingered all these years, and now is finally, at least within South Dakota, is out in the open because of Jonathan's reporting.
Now, the Nixon campaign knew that McGovern had fathered a child in the early 40s. That comes out in the article. Jonathan, why didn't the Nixon campaign use this information? Was it simply that they didn't need to?
Yeah, I think that that's probably the case. I mean, you know, my story, while it doesn't definitively connect all the dots, certainly points to the fact that under J. Edgar Hoover, before he died in May of 1972, that information was released to the Nixon administration via the FBI. But, you know, the McGovern campaign, for all the idealism that was behind it, I mean, this is the first time 18-year-olds could vote. I mean, there's this backlash against Vietnam, especially among young people. I mean, you know, it sort of sparked this idealism of a generation, at least a certain segment of a generation. You know, for all of that, you know, it was really a flawed campaign, and you know, it was staggering from day one, the day that McGovern got the nomination, and the Nixon administration just never needed to go heavy-handed. And in fact, you know, H.R. Haldeman, one of Nixon's aides, and when Seth talks about this being in plain view, admitted during congressional hearings, Watergate hearings in 73, that they had this information and never used it. That was reported in a story by Carl Bernstein and Bernstein and Woodward, you know, the famous duo on Watergate. That was reported in a story by the Washington Post, and it just never, you know, this is the age before internet. And I think what happened with that whole story was that it just, I think Watergate sort of enveloped everything, and it just sort of disappeared. You know, I think that at that point in time, the press and the public was fixated on Watergate, and the McGovern child just didn't exist at that point.
Seth Tupper, what do you think this revelation means for McGovern's reputation? Does it damage it at all, or should it even change what we think about McGovern today?
Well, I think there's two different aspects of that. I mean, obviously, it doesn't. I don't think it impacts his public service record. I mean, the things he did to fight hunger, and the things he did to try to end the Vietnam War, and the things he's famous for. Obviously, he still did all those things. I don't think it detracts from that whatsoever. On the personal side, though, as just a historical figure and a man and a person, obviously, it does change our conception of who he was, and adds a layer to that. And then, you know, and what's interesting is, you know, McGovern was a trained historian. He had a history degree. And so he probably knew that this would happen at some point, that a much fuller picture of his life would emerge. And hopefully, I think, as Jonathan mentioned in his story, you know, there's a biography that's going to come out on McGovern soon. And hopefully we'll learn even more from that.
Well, Jonathan, what has been the reaction of readers to the Argus Theater story about McGovern's FBI files?
You know, overwhelmingly positive. I mean, I did receive a gentleman who didn't identify himself, who left a couple messages in which he called me a scumbag. I presumably he's for going after a dead person. I don't know if he means I was going after McGovern or Hoover. I don't know. But anyway, I'm looking at this from a historical perspective, and it's been generally overwhelming. People, I think, really appreciate the history of all of this. You know, and so you know, certainly was not our intent to go after anybody. But we as journalists are interested in history, and this was very, very interesting, fascinating from my perspective.
Fascinating because wondering what the, you know, the what's really so fascinating is this, the McGovern and his times and the relationship to the FBI and Hoover.
I mean, McGovern was very brave to take on J. Edgar Hoover. He wasn't the only, you know, there were several Democratic senators that they were kind of keeping track of, but he was very public in going after arguably the most powerful man, the lawman in the country, and had been for decades, J. Edgar Hoover. And so that says a lot about George McGovern, that he was willing to publicly go after this guy.
Well, finally, looking at this George McGovern story, the whole reaction to this, Seth Tupper, as you mentioned, you spent some time in Mitchell. What do you think McGovern's relationship is with the people in South Dakota today? Is he still something of a controversial figure?
Oh, absolutely. And anybody who rises to a high position as a Democrat in South Dakota, being a heavily registered Republican state, you know, there'll always be, that kind of conflicted relationship. I think Daschle suffered the same thing, because there's a lot of Republicans in the state who didn't want him in office to begin with. And, so this is further ammunition for them to attack his legacy. Supporters will say, you know, hey, this doesn't detract from his career as a public servant. But he, you know, it's a complex relationship. It always was when he was in office, and I think it'll remain that way, you know, now that he's gone and as historians look at him.
Well, that'll have to do it for the Dakota Political Junkies this week. Seth, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us.
You're welcome.
And Jonathan, thanks for your time as well.
Hey, thank you, Carl.